All right. Welcome back, everyone, to the podcast. This is Mo. There's a Yoruba saying that Tiaba Mono Akebaje, meaning if we know the way, we won't get lost. But for Black men facing prostate cancer, navigating the way isn't always clear. In fact, Black men globally face the highest rates of prostate cancer diagnosis and mortality, with Black men being 2.3 times more likely to die from the disease than their other counterparts. In Nigeria, for example, now we know that prostate cancer now accounts for over 11% of all male cancers and is often diagnosed late, leading to poorer outcomes. And that number is, I feel, in my opinion, is underreported, because sometimes people die and they don't know it was due to prostate cancer. And not from disease, maybe just from the complications or maybe treatment and all that. Today's guest is someone who I met a couple of years ago. And I just want to say that it's such an honor to bring him on the podcast to really add more robustness to some of the work we've done with, you know, other survivors. And in 2017, today's guest joined the statistics, but not passively. With his analytical mind and deep commitment to service, he turned his diagnosis into a data-driven journey of decision-making, discipline, and delayed treatment through active surveillance. But as we're here today, his story isn't just about what happened to him. It's about what he chose to do for himself, his family, and his commitment and his community. And when I say that it's an honor to have him on the podcast, I really, really do mean it. So with me today is someone who has over 30 years as an innovative IT executive in the financial services sector, and 2 decades as a patent law practitioner. He's built a life around thoughtful problem solving. And for the past 20 years, he has served as an executive vice president to a nonprofit that provides healthcare in Nigeria, particularly prostate health screenings for men. In today's conversations, we'll explore the man behind the diagnosis, from his formative years in Nigeria to his leadership in community health, and how facing prostate cancer reshaped the way he gives, lives, and leads. Everyone, please join me in welcoming Mr. Ronald Odeleye to the podcast.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. It's a pleasure being here. It's been really a treat working alongside Professor.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I think there's a saying that says we are who we were until life asks us to become someone new, right? Now, before we talk about just your journey, we want to understand the man who made it. So let's go back to the beginning, to the early influences, family values, and foundations that shaped your approach to life in general.
Excellent. I was born in Ibadan, Nigeria, it would be Western region at that time, many, many years ago. I was born in Ibadan, in Nigeria. And I grew up as the third of 7 children to my mom and dad.
Wow.
And my childhood was a dream. We lived in Bodija. Bodija at the time, we were the first residents of Bodija. We moved into Bodija estate in 1959. I was just barely a year old. And in those days, we've got a very diverse group. Names like Rego Martin, Pinheiro, Gonsalves, Thomas, Michael. Those are the kinds of names around. There were Hausa. There were Igbo people alongside living. And we would walk down the streets as we grew up and pluck all kinds of fruits of the streets, because they were growing lushly across the estate. We moved to Lagos. I feel like personally, I was the most loved person in the world. I feel like I'm the favorite of my siblings. I feel like I'm the favorite of my parents. A favorite of everyone. That's the way I
That's
I
quite a case for someone who was 3rd out of 7 kids.
I still hold to that claim. And one story that really stand out to me was I was walking back. There was a coup, the first coup in Nigeria, the military coup that took over. I was just in primary one, which means I was probably 5 or 6 years old at the time. And the coup occurred and the school was dispersed. Usually a car would pick us up at a place. I walked up to the place. There was nobody there. My brother, who was also in the school with me, was gone. And I decided to walk home. That's a far away place.
How many miles?
That's Mokola to Bodija is probably at least 3 or 4 miles, maybe 5 to where we live.
And you knew the way?
I found my way there.
This was before Google Maps and all that.
Yes, way before Google Maps. And the interesting part is that I actually walked through the military coup, oblivious to everything. My parents were going wild. Everybody in the neighborhood was waiting, but it took a while, but I got home. And it was actually through a wilderness that nobody dared to go to. So at that point in time, and when I reflect back to my life, I feel convinced that I must be a purpose. And until my purpose is served, I'm not going anywhere.
Wow. So. Wow. You can say you had your wilderness journey before it became a thing.
Yeah.
Wow. I forgot to do this. Sorry about that. Special shout out to your sister, Dr. Akiremi, because I met you through her, and just everyone who knows her can attest to just how sweet of a person she is and just her heart towards people. So your boots are like in so many ways. So I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you so much, Dr. Akiremi, for making this introduction many years ago. All right, so Bodija, my yes. mom is from Oyo, by the way, and mom is from Oyo. My grandma. I grew up in Lagos, but I spent some time with my grandma as a kid until I think I was 2, because my mom was still in college when she had me, so I had to go stay with my grandma for a while. I don't remember any of those early memories, but I went to school in Oyo for my high school. I went to a boarding house there. Federal Government Girls College, Oyo.
Oh, okay. Owing. That was probably.
Yeah,
before my time.
Yes. And my brother lives near Ashi, by the way, Bodija, which is,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so, okay.
Yeah, I was still there.
Familiar grounds.
Yes. I worked at UCH briefly for a year, for my NYC.
Okay.
I just love Ibadan. There's a way it beckons at you. Like, the history is so preserved, and the people, they can be quite chaotic, but it's Ibadan that you go, you never try to price anything in the market. Like, I remember one time, you know, in Lagos, you just hop from one store to another store.
Yeah.
And in Ibadan, the way the woman dressed me down, I was like, never again. If I'm not going to buy, I'm not going to touch. I remember one time when I moved to Ibadan for work, and I was trying to get a cab, and I was running after the cab, and people started looking at me. Ah, I'm like, oh, lele, this one is from Lagos. We don't run after cabs.
Different territory.
Yeah. And then my dad got me a Nissan Micra for my, because he had promised me that if I finished the first class, he was going to buy me a car.
Well,
he
nice.
Bought me a Nissan Micra. I was so happy. It was green. And I moved to Ibadan shortly after. Guess the kind of car they were using in Ibadan for cabs. And it was a Micra, and it was painted green. So my car, they were always handing it down.
That's so crazy stuff.
I have so many stories about Ibadan. Anyways, thanks for sharing all of that with us. And I mean, I imagine that you have so many stories, especially growing up and the kind of memories you have and your family and all of that. Now, what work did your parents do? Because living in Bodija, Lagos, what kind of job did your mom and dad do?
My mom was a teacher. Mm. She was a primary school teacher. She taught primaries 1 and 2. So that's the elementary school. That's what she did for all of her life professionally. But she was also a hustler. She still is. She made all kinds of stuff, like pap. She made stuff that she made us go to sell. Bodija estate in those days was a upper middle class area. We were the only kids in the area that used to carry stuff in our head and go to sell.
Wasn't that embarrassing for you?
We didn't know anything at the time. We just put the stuff down and play soccer and then keep going. But in reflection, I don't know what everybody else thought. My dad, he was very busy. He was in government service. Started his life very early. He was probably one of the first persons that got degreed remotely from the University of England or the University of London in England. And so he was an economist. He ended up with a PhD out of the New York University, I think, one of those. But all of these degrees he earned remotely.
Wow.
But remotely, all of them.
wait. Yeah. This was way back before we had Zoom and Udemy.
All of those
remotely
things.
Correspondence courses?
Correspondence.
The diligence.
Yeah, he was, it was something else. He was always writing. At the peak of his career in federal government, he was like a permanent secretary, but he was in charge of the National Library.
Wow.
And his lesson that he taught, and we'll touch on this maybe a little bit, was about ethics. He is the most ethical person that I know. But he was in federal service, University of Ife. He was the one that helped to establish that university. Now he's at Obafemi Awolowo University.
What? I didn't know that.
When the structures were being built, we were there during that period when he was in the University of Ife was being incubated at the Polytechnic of Ibadan. He was right in the middle of it. So he did a lot of things, but probably what he'll say is most his best achievement was probably raising us kids. He was not the disciplinarian my mom was, but he was always there. He was always encouraging us. He showed us a good life. I went to England very early in my life. He traveled extensively around the world. The reason why I came to the U.S. specifically to Michigan, when I decided to escape Nigeria, I used that word very loosely. I intended to go back, just never did. I met that woman, you know.
Yeah, beautiful woman, by the way.
Yeah, it was because when it was doing the research of what the University of Ife was going to be, University of Michigan was one of those universities he stopped by at. So to appease him, I came to the University of Michigan. He wasn't appeased because he didn't want me to come to the U.S. But UK, that's far enough. Those gun-carrying people in the U.S., really? You don't want any part of them. Anyways, that was them. He had an illustrious life in service. And he left and went to help to establish the original Oyo State. Now has been split into multiple factions, but back in the mid-1970s, he left federal service. He rejected ambassadorial positions to go back to help to start up the state. And then he decided that he wanted to go back and to go back to his people. We are from Ilora. Ilora is just adjacent to Oyo. And that's where I spent the last 25 years of his life, I would say.
Wow.
Yeah. But he was dedicated to service. And
That makes a lot of sense. Now, I know you have a foundation in honor of him,
Edel
Ogunokun Odele, which we'll talk about in a bit. It makes a lot of sense now, just your passion behind that and what you'll do back in the community. But I'm curious, you know, apart from what you have done with the foundation, are there ways that the Nigerian government, for example, have honored your father, especially the role he played in public service?
No, not at all. Mm. He told this. He would, if they did, it wouldn't be something I'm privy to, but I do not believe so.
Wow.
His fight was not for
recognition.
It was more, it was very grounded in the people. He's, he's gentle, but he will fight for a cause he believes in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds a lot like you.
which is great.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for that, Sam. All right, let's segue a little bit into your cancer diagnosis. Now, in hearing your story a few years ago, I remember you had said through your foundation, because one of the things you guys provide is healthcare.
Yeah.
At grassroots level. And you are also a proponent of like free screening and prostate cancer screening. And you didn't know a lot of what went behind it until you had your diagnosis. It made you rethink a lot of what you had done. I think this would be a good time to kind of walk us through that journey. Especially, and as you're talking about that, if you can also let us know, you know, 4 years into your active surveillance and just decision that shifts when you decided to have surgery. Because, I mean, we as a team, we've been almost like we're there. We observe closely just your thoughtful approach to it. And I think that's a great conversation to have, especially for some of our men who might still be thinking about what do I do and how do I approach the decision. I think the way you went about it, especially the data-driven way and knowing yourself very well, would be a great way to really encourage those that might be experiencing this. So I'll just give you the time to, you know, share your story.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you. So just a brief background, as you kindly, graciously introduced earlier, my professional background is really about solving problems, either in patent law or at the bank in IT. It's about finding a problem, looking for the root cause and driving that problem out so it doesn't come back. That's the goal. So with that, as a backdrop, when we went into healthcare outreach in Nigeria, it was about identifying key issues in the community and seeking to solve them. Hypertension was rampant, breast cancer was rampant, and we were beginning to see a lot of men with prostate health issues. And so, also, cataract issues in the eye was also very rampant. So we were there intentionally, not just screening generally, because it's, going to the doctor every year is a good thing.
Yeah.
So, people that can't afford it, they have a free access to those kinds of screening and just general health. And we provided medication. We also provided. We actually have an active service point still in Elora where people can go and seek help from diabetes and high blood pressure check, and also discounted their medication for those kinds of services. So it's in that search for the prostate health issues in the area and the community served the FEU local government, which include many, many towns. I think the population at the time when we started was probably about 250,000. That's the population of the local government. And the people came from far and wide.
And this is Oyo State, right?
This is Oyo State, yes, FEU local government. But what we also observe is that men don't like coming. They always make excuses for why they come. But when you have a targeted outreach for them, like prostate health, the ones that have the symptoms always end up showing up. So if we had on a given day, we have 300, 500 people show up, they'll say probably about 20% of them would be men. The rest of them would be women. Market women, they always find a way to show up. Men, hunters, or whatever they call themselves, whatever profession they have, they always find an excuse not to show up. But these men would show up when there's a targeted outreach. So prostate health was one. And we reached them through churches and mosques, and just the local government will push out notice. And then, of course, we have flyers leading up to the time when we would come. So we got crowds. And then we'll have professionals come to help with the screening. And when we identify men with high PSAs, high PSAs in those days, it's anything about 4. When it gets to about 10, that's when we start chasing them down.
Right.
And asking them to go and see the surgeon. Surgeons is affiliated with the Federal Medical Center in Abeokuta. That was very helpful. We still have connections with a lot of those urologists. And so they'll take a look and then they'll make recommendations. If the recommendation was surgery, the men were usually very scared. But I don't know that they know anything about, like, we have a lot of information these days in here in the U.S. about the outcomes of surgery. Those people probably didn't have that much information. They just know that they're having problems. There's a treatment for it. And my pitch was, because this is what I knew, is if you don't do it, you may die. What's that? What you want? And so sometimes I would deploy people to go find them in their compound and track them down and give them the means to get to Abeokuta to go get this stuff done, because the surgery cannot be done locally. We don't have the kind of facilities to do that. So we did that. And so what that informed me in those days was that, there's a problem here that we need to keep looking at. But I'd say we started this about 2005, nonprofit started in 2003. The prostate health about 2005 or so. And but my diagnosis didn't happen until 2017.
Wow.
And when I look back, I start thinking about how many men I have committed to this stuff. And I knew at the time that in 2017, I had to make a decision as to how to proceed. That maybe the standard of care has changed, and it probably did between when we started and when I was diagnosed. I became more sensitive to the treatment and the communication with these men. My own personal experience now informed what I do and how I talk to the men. As you pointed out, when the diagnosis was made, it was still below, my PSA was still below 4 at the time. And the young lady that was my urologist at the time, Dr. Hernandez, she's still doing great work. But the reason why I submitted myself to her, because it's always like, this guy, first of all, I don't like the DRE, the digital rectal exam, and then of course there's this young lady. My daughter was at the time at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, doing her residency in urology. So I'm looking at this lady, I'm thinking about my daughter. Well, my daughter gets in front of a man somewhere along the line practicing this stuff.
Daughter is a physician, by the way, in case you missed that.
So that's how I decided that it doesn't matter who my doctor is. It could be male or female. Yeah. This is a disease. This is an expert who is going to help me. So when the diagnosis was made, my doctor wanted to talk to me about options. And I said, wait a minute. I need to invite my family here, my wife, my daughters, my sister, And my closest family members that are also important to me in this decision process, because whatever decision I make was going to affect them.
Yeah.
So they brought us into this big conference room, and I think my sister was on the phone, and I think Daniela was on the phone as well. We were in this conference room. It was filled with myself and my close people. And she described what it was that I have to them, and what the prognosis was for long term, and how we can proceed. And we decided at the time, collectively, that active surveillance was the treatment to go with. So the fact that we were able to make that decision together, I think, was very helpful in the duration of my stay on active surveillance, because that was a decision we made, and that was a decision that we knew we had to deal with every 6 months and check on. So making the decision with the family and being transparent with the people that are closest to you, that you most likely are going to be most impacted by your decision, I think is very important. So that's how we got to active surveillance. Background with experience, chasing people down to have the standard of care treatment, which was either radiation or radical surgery, to look, prostate cancer is not going to kill you quickly. Most of the time, it's a slow moving cancer. Most of the time, your life is going to expire before prostate cancer gets you. So that's the second lesson over time. There are markers that let you know whether you have an accelerating cancer or whether you have a slow-moving cancer. And the doctor would know that. So ask questions when you get in front of your physician. It's important to know that the first stage is determining, have you discovered this early enough? I discovered in 2017, I think I was almost 59 years old at the time. I was old at the time. And 59 year old. And, but I was always had seen my doctor. So the progression about your PSA is going up, your PSA is going up, those were always been there. We didn't get into biopsy really until it got to a point where it's indicating that maybe this is not just benign, prostate hyperplasia.
Yeah.
That's enlarged prostate, that is something more.
Yeah.
And that's, and the diagnosis was finally made. But the fact that the prostate wasn't big at the time to warrant a decision that this is a BPH or enlarged prostate. And later on, 4 years later, it's 2021 or so, my doctors here in Utah concluded that, they noted that I have a very large prostate. And so two things to take away from that is one, your PSA, especially when you have this combo, it's very difficult to tell which one is driving your PSA. Is it the prostate cancer, which is or is it the
BPH enlarged prostate?
Yeah, so, and when the PSA begins to accelerate, at the point of surgery decision for me, that my PSA was dancing around the low, mid-30s. And remember, 4 was the cutoff point where you need to start worrying, and 10, I used to send people to the gallows or send them to surgery. And I was at the height of my PSA reading. It was 36 just before surgery.
Wow.
Yeah. My prostate itself at the time was probably 3 or 4 times the normal size.
But did you mention that during your surgery, it ended up being like a saving grace for you because it could see a lot of things better?
Well, yeah. It's that instead of growing and pushing at the bladder, it was pushing down. And that's why my symptoms were relatively benign. It wasn't pushing against the bladder, which was going to be problematic in terms of trying to get the prostate out and make sure nothing else is damaged. So a lot of blessings because of the size of the prostate.
Wow. I have so many wrapping up thoughts and so many follow-up questions. So let's start with just the very beginning part. So I think one of the things that really strikes me about your path is when you were talking about your foundation and in the early years when you you had, like, whenever you guys do your community outreaches, following through with participants. I'm still a missionary, but when I was on the field, that was one of the hardest things to do, to really be able to trace participants. This was before GSMs and phones, and I can't imagine the amount of manpower that went into that. But I think the way you guys went about it, that's really great, by the way, because not many foundations have that capacity to follow through participants that don't have full addresses or, you know, home numbers and or phone numbers to, like, get through with them. So I should just give that back to you. And I think even your openness, I can imagine just how complex it must feel, right? First being both an advocate and then later a patient yourself. Like, it's one thing to offer guidance from a place of knowledge and another to experience that same journey firsthand. But what really strikes me, because I've heard this story a couple of times, you've been very open about it. I think what strikes me the most is your humility in releasing those decisions. And I don't think it's to undo the work you've done, but to really evolve. Like, in those moments when you're recommending surgery and recommending them to go to Abeokuta, you were doing the best you could with the information you had. And it was also motivated by the care and urgency, especially in a setting like ours, like in rural areas where prostate cancer is often cut so late. Now, the fact that you're willing to now question those decisions you made and see that maybe it wasn't always the right way to, like, offer the standard of care. I think that's, to be able to grow from that, I think is incredibly powerful. And I think it's also a gift to the very same men and communities you've served, right? And I mean, you didn't do it out of harm. You did it out of just the knowledge you had then. And then when you later experience that, you've grown from that. And I think that's still part of the human journey. And I hope you give yourself enough grace to never feel regretful about that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's funny, just anecdotally, I tell a story about the eye exam and the cataract surgeries that we did. We do. We call it an eye outreach. We bring people in and get them taken care of. The people that take them in, they think they're blind. They get in there, doctors take the cataract out and put new lenses in, and people think they have been saved. It's like a miracle. Well, miracle of science. We never had a single mishap in that space except one. My uncle, my mom's younger brother, was one of the first patients that we saw. Not the first. It was probably a couple of years into this series of, but in that surgery, some lens got, maybe it was cropping him too hard. He got lost in his eye and essentially almost lost that eye, but we didn't know for years. He complained and complained and complained, and everything that we tried to do, we didn't see it. Now, this is not just the problem of Nigeria. My nephew suffered the same thing in the UK. He's just getting through it in the past week. It was just in surgery Thursday of last week, so 8 days ago. People can't see what you are seeing in front of your eyes because it's so little. But he ended up scratching his cornea and damaging his eye in the process. So I say that only because even then, with the best of intentions,
Yeah, I still have that. Yeah,
and it was my family. It was my uncle. So you're right. I take everything you said with grace. And thank you.
And I think it also speaks to the kind of person you are, being able to be that introspective and you know, think through our decisions. I mean, not everyone has that. Let me just put it, bandwidth. Because life is sometimes as such a fast pace.
Yeah.
But I hope that in those moments, you're not full of regrets, because again, it wasn't done to harm, you know, the community. And for most of the things we do, unless we go through those journeys ourselves, we just do what we do, what we know, right? Yeah.
This is so true, because it's, I remind myself all the time, even through active surveillance, unless the doctor has experienced what I'm experiencing,
right,
they can only pontificate, because every human body is different, and we all, in the end, will always react. We'll experience that same treatment differently, and we have to be cognizant enough and humble enough to know that doctors are going to try their best.
But
it's a total transformation of the body when somebody goes in there and start messing with God, what God created.
Exactly. Exactly. And as we're talking about, unless the doctor has gone through, I just laugh because I used to have a lot of gynecological issues, and 9 out of 10 of my doctors were all males, and they will never get to experience what I've gone through. So I guess I can leave the jokes for another day, or maybe the jokes write themselves. I also wanted to talk a little bit about active surveillance before we move on to the next discussion. So for those who might be wondering, active surveillance is a way to monitor prostate cancer instead of treating it right away. And it's usually recommended when the cancer is slow growing, low risk, or not causing any symptoms. So think of it like this. You're keeping a close eye on the situation, not ignoring it, but also not jumping into surgery or radiation unless it becomes necessary. Now, because many, like what Mr. Adelaide said, because many prostate cancers grow very slowly, especially in the early stages, immediate treatment isn't always needed. But you can't do that in isolation. Make sure you have a doctor, a team you trust really well, because treatments like surgery or radiation can actually have more side effects, like, you know, sexual dysfunction or not being able to control your bowels. So active surveillance helps avoid those side effects unless treatment becomes truly necessary. So if you remember, Mr. Adela said his PSA, which is like a test to monitor your cancer, as it were, it was low initially, and then it got, you know, up to 36, which is really high. So for PSA, we look at it's age dependent, right? So when it's like 0 to 2.5, that's generally considered low or normal for most men. But greater than 10, you're looking at high likelihood increased of prostate cancer. He also talked about benign prostatic hyperplasia, which simply means an enlarged prostate. It's not cancerous, but it can cause similar urinary symptoms, like going to the toilet more frequently to pee, your stream is weak, or you have trouble starting or stopping your pee. And this is quite common, especially as men age, so over 50. So think of it like the prostate is growing larger over time, and there's a ring tightening around a straw, like the urethra, which can affect your urine flow. Now, in Mr. Adelaide's case, while he was initially diagnosed with prostate cancer, but when they evaluated him further, they found that he had BPH. And this overlap can make diagnosis and decision-making more complicated, especially when symptoms don't match the severity of cancer. Now, another thing you talked about was your family. As you know, we've done a lot of research in men and talking to men. I think one of the most striking things that I loved about your story was that you didn't walk this journey alone. And I've had some men talk about not involving their families for, you know, whatever their reasons were. But you talking about involving your wife and children in every major decision, like that conference call, whether it was your monitoring, even your sisters or biopsies, and finally opting for surgery. I think that level of openness, I would like to highlight that, the importance of putting people that you trust. And I know not everyone has that luxury, but prostate cancer is not a cancer in isolation. It affects the family. So for our men out there, we know it's difficult. And in doing the studies that we've done with men for the past years, we've seen all kinds of men and all kinds of levels of decision. But the ones that have had a better outcome, family support or social support, it doesn't have to be your family, but people you it could be your church group, but always find somebody that you can carry along, right? And in totally. Many communities, yeah, we see that men are taught to be a thing silently. And this kind of vulnerability within the family, like what you shared, I think is both rare and deeply powerful. And I wanted to highlight that.
Yeah.
So thank you.
I'm encouraged by sharing. I think is what I've found over time. There are also things that maybe I hadn't gotten far enough. When I reflect, in my immediate family, I was very open. I tell my siblings everything. I talk to them every day. I talk to my wife and daughters about this situation and every other situation that are important to me. So, but we're raised as men to be protectors, and protectors don't want to feel like they're weak. And when you start showing vulnerability, you begin to feel that there's a weakness there. What I found post-surgery, by the way, is that I think one of my best friends, he's a pathologist. He's also one of my daughter's godfathers. He told me after, I guess he found out that I had gone through some surgery, and I spoke with him, he told me that, you know, I went through a different surgery. He had BPH, but that was bothering him 2 years ago. 2 years ago. I didn't know.
Wow.
And he didn't know that I was struggling from...
And this is your best friend.
Yeah. I don't talk to him often.
Yeah.
And when I talk to him about health stuff, I talk to him about what his expertise is, cardiology.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's my mom's... He appointed himself as my mom's cardiologist, so he's in my mom's blood pressure and all those things. That was always the subject of our conversation, but I didn't talk to him about this.
Oh, wow.
But post-surgery, another one of my best friends, I have three of them. Yeah. He's in Michigan. We came to the U.S. together, essentially went to school together, and he's the other godfather of my daughter, so she's got... but he, when I described my experience with him as I was going through this journey, he knew I had prostate cancer. He knew I was going to go through surgery. He was going to come out and spend time with me. Well, there was too many people that wanted to come out, so I told him to hold off. But when I tell him every day how my body is reacting to post-surgery and what I'm experiencing myself, he concluded that he needed to go and talk to his urologist because he was having some symptoms. He's been dealing with these symptoms for a while. Luckily, didn't have prostate cancer. And luckily, the situation is not anything close to even the BPH. But the urologist he talked to last week turned out to be he needed to get more rest. he had frequent urinary symptoms. He gets up in the night so many times, but had nothing to do with his prostate. His PSA was good. But he said that was what influenced him to go, because somebody was talking to him and was open about that conversation. So us that have gone through the experience, I think we need to be macho about this stuff, but we need to be transparent, because people experience treatment differently again. And unless people know that we're coming to them with openness and transparency, they'll hear different stories all over the place and they'll think, okay, I'm not getting the full picture. But they want to hear what the real life experience is, not the coded experience. And I think that's important if we're going to get more people involved
In
diagnosis and treatment.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I love that. That's definitely a lot to unpack there, especially not just for families, but also healthcare providers, right? The importance of transparency. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Before we go into recovery, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit on this. So you've talked about your family being involved, try your wife and your kids. Now, for men who might be listening to this, because we know that in our community, for a lot of our men, it's not a matter of if or when they will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, right? And what advice would you give to other families, you know, navigating a cancer diagnosis? It could be prostate or otherwise, especially in communities where emotions or illness aren't openly discussed.
That's a deep question. Mm. I think illness of any type is personal, and that journey is a difficult one. If you keep what I've learned over time in all aspects of my life, is when I keep things to myself and think I only can solve the problem, I always find out that that's not the case. And if you think that the people out there, and there may be some, going to either mock you, make fun of you, or they're going to look at you differently, yeah, maybe 2, 5, 10% even of the people who do that, but the majority will not do that. They would pray with you. They would pray for you. They would be considerate of you. And when you get to a point where people are asking you, how's your cancer doing? You can tell them that it's okay. You don't have to talk about that. You can find boundaries that doesn't push, doesn't make the cancer a subject of your conversation. Your conversation is a lot broader. You are a lot bigger than cancer. But you also have to be able to talk about it, because when you don't talk about it, as I said with my friend, the HoLEP procedure that he did to hollow out the inside of his prostate, that was one of the considerations I had, because the complications that come with super large prostate like I had was also one of the reasons why going into full surgery was a little deferred for me. But if I could have hollowed out the inside of the prostate at the time, maybe I would have made a decision to surgery earlier, or maybe I would have taken a different approach, a more targeted approach to surgery. But if you don't talk about this stuff, then you don't get all the help you need. So you have to talk about it. It's not you. You're not at fault for the disease. The disease is what it is. And there are many reasons why that disease can come. It could be hereditary. It could be something that you, and you always ask that question, was this something I could have eaten differently? Should I have exercised a lot more? What is it that I couldn't do or didn't do that caused this stuff? But it is what it is. Right, you are the problem. You got to solve the problem. So how do you go about solving the problem? People are there to help. You got to talk about it. You have to reach out, and the more you reach out, the better you'll feel in the end.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. I think for some men, it's just difficult to accept, you know, why me. You can do the right things, avoid alcohol, avoid cigarette smoking. But if your genes are rigged against you, and one of the risk factors for prostate cancer is having a family history of it. And in our communities where we don't share, I've spoken to men who refuse to even tell their sons about their diagnosis because they don't want them worrying. But we know now that when we withhold such family information, we put them at risk, right? So find people you trust. Don't do this alone. Women were a lot better with that. We talk about everything. We call our girlfriends and we're like, you know, downloading everything. And we're better off because there's that safety in that community. So men, please don't do this alone, okay? Find people who you trust, right? I think one more question for this would be, now, in talking to some of the men that we've explored their stories through our research, there's also their fear of, you know, especially men that might have younger wives, or men with, with wives, you know, with who are partnered up. And there's that fear of being less than, you know. One big thing is the sexual expectations, and that role reversal when there's that vulnerability and you're not feeling man enough, right? How would you say your own journey has been, especially with your wife and having to not, like, because I know for these men who talk about this, is the concern is, I don't want to be a disappointment to my wife, right? Because we had this, you know, great marriage, and all of a sudden I don't feel man enough. What has been, would you say, some of the lessons you've learned that you'd like to recycle for men who might be navigating this issue?
Yeah. So at the very core of my decision to not only go with active surveillance, but to stay with active surveillance for so long, is that I know what my quality of life is.
Mm.
And I want to not change my quality of life. And that included not having to wake up in the middle of the night, or not having to be wearing diapers around, or not having to, all the other horror stories you heard about post-surgical experiences. So I don't want any of that. My doctors were very transparent in letting me know, here are the possible things, but you're very healthy. You don't have the typical physical structural attributes of the people that have these fallout after surgery. And so if we do it, you'll be just fine. They always say quality of life, quality of life, quality of life. So the men that are apprehensive about impact, I'll tell you my story. Again, everybody is different. On the funny side, I don't weigh a lot, but I lost 8 pounds after surgery, so I'm trying to gain some more weight. I have a planned surgery for October the 3rd. Too long for me. I like to go back and do it now because I developed what's called incisional hernia. The robotic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
They put 5 holes in you and then one big slit.
Mm-hmm.
The hole right above my navel is one that is kind of bubbling up as a hernia. I need to go back in there and sew it down. So not everybody experiences that. Of all the people that could experience that, I wasn't supposed to be one of them, but I did anyways. My urinary symptoms are essentially gone. I'm very happy with that. There's one result that seemed to be interesting or exciting is the fact that I don't have to sit on the pot for a minute or 2 minutes. I can just go there, do my thing, and be done. Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm too graphic. I'm not this stand up and shoot kind of person. I sit down. Maybe that's part of my problem with prostate. I don't know. I always sit down on the pot, do everything I do just like kids do. The erectile dysfunction, I think, which is probably the other part of what the scary life story is with this, I think it's very important. In whatever treatment you take, and some of those treatments might include just the radical prostatectomy, anything that could impact your sexual health. I think it's important because even though you may not be active or very active, and being transparent, I think when I was younger, I was a lot more active sexually. It was more interesting these days. And for the longest time, that wasn't a priority anymore. In the order of things that are important, sex hasn't been one of those things. That some people are more hungry for it than others. I think my wife and I have a healthy relationship.
That's great.
I can feel as much love from a touch. And that's been a long time. It didn't come after the diagnosis. It's just been, I feel better when my skin is next to yours. Brings me joy. But some people are hungry. That's the way they are wired. And this is very important. It's also very important. And I think if we close on the subject of survivorship in prostate cancer, I think we'll touch on this more expansively. Men often attribute their manhood, their identity, their confidence to their ability to perform, even if they don't expect to perform. I think in truth, even though it wasn't a priority for me, the loss of my prostate made me realize what if I change my mind? What if I change my mind and this becomes very important for me? How do I deal with that? Can I deal with that? It's a loss. And in picking a treatment option, I think it's very important that men consider this. If it's a priority for them, then their choice of treatment has to be inclusive of this. Your quality of life may be impacted one way or the other. On the bright side, I said, when my daughter was young and we used to travel from Detroit to New York or New York to Atlanta and far away 10, 12 hours drive, I'm content to just drive and never stop to use the restroom.
Yeah.
My daughter, the first road trip we took, she was probably, I don't know, she had 3 years old. We told her she needs to use the restroom before we left home. She said she did. 2 miles on the freeway. She got to go. I gotta go. That's when I learned that I'm wired differently than these girls, and I have to be prepared to stop on the road. But the quality of life issue is one that I think needs to be talked about. More subjectively, because it's different for everybody.
I love that. And I think there's so much we can learn from that, not just as, you know, for the patient perspective, but also from the healthcare providers and asking the right questions. Like, what do you want to prioritize? What's important to you? And I hope that for men listening or even their wives or family members, you can also help them shape that. But it comes from a place of conversation and knowing oneself, right? Defining what quality of life means to you, right?
You know, one of the things that I started to, one of our guests at our town hall, I don't remember who it was, emphasized that, but I don't think everybody caught it. Mm. Or maybe it's some book I read. But the question I was asking in my head was, is there a checklist of... decision-making... How do I make the decision of the right treatment for me? What are those things I need to check and prioritize and score to get to a point where I say, okay, I'm going to make this decision now, and it's an objective list that's inclusive of what are those things that are most important to me, not my doctor, but to me and my family, because that's who's going to have to live with it when the decision has been made. So, leading up to treatment, when the decision was made, I grew up in a very prayerful family. We grew up as Baptists, but all that exotic denominations out there. I'm still Baptist. I still claim that. But everybody else has probably gone a different way. But they are also a lot more prayerful than I am. A month before I went into surgery, I think we were meeting every day for prayer, me and my siblings, all six of them, every day to pray for me.
Oh, wow.
They still continue to pray today. I still get, and some of them, pastors, and that's a part-time, almost full-time job in one case. And I am always brought back to certain passages in the Bible. I love Psalm 91. Like, that's my favorite Bible. I think I can't even tell you that's my favorite, but I love that.
Was it?
he who dwells in Psalm 91.
Oh, I love that. He who dwells in the Most High shall abide under the shadow of my mom used to make us recite it as kids. I know the King James version and the NIV version. The King James version is very dramatic. Of the fowler. What is the fowler, mother?
It is a powerful,
very powerful.
Jeremiah 29:11 also says,
I know the
plans I have for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. Plans to prosper you and not harm you, mm-hmm. and plans to give you hope and the future.
Expecting it, yeah.
So even in this difficult situation, I have to tell you, my situation is not
hopeless.
There has to be a purpose, mm-hmm. right? Because 2 weeks after my treatment, 2 or 3 weeks after my treatment, I found a different treatment for me that I would have preferred.
I remember you said that.
So I came out of...
And that was never brought up in any of your options given to you?
Any of them. My doctors didn't have a lot of options. I always was the one advocating and suggesting, can I try this one? I'll get a referral to the expert. We'll talk about it over there. And I still wasn't sure whether I wanted to get cut up because there's some targeted therapies that are out there that would have done some good and would have, but the level of cancer that I have, which is stage one, worst stage two, early stage two, those would have dealt with it. But even in my own research, I couldn't trust my urologist to do my research for me because they didn't do it.
They
want to cut eventually. That's what they did.
So just wants to cut. Yeah.
Yeah. But so I rest in knowledge that, as Ecclesiastes taught us, for everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven. This is my season to go through this process, and there's a reason for it, which is going to be exposed to me sooner than later. This is not a waste. This is on purpose. Otherwise, I would have found that therapy, which would have worked better for me, and I would have just been who I am. Once surgery is done, and this is the truth.
Yeah.
Once surgery is done, there's... Right now, no going back. My brother, who is the reverend, he tells me that there's a miracle in the works. God is capable of doing anything.
And I
believe that. Something can come up anytime, at any given time, that helps us to restore our prostate. I'm not losing hope. But I'm not dwelling on that either.
Okay. Yeah.
What I know is that when my doctor, my urologist, my primary urologist, and I talked to dozens of them, experts, one of the top radiologists in the country, is a good friend of my daughter, and he told me a long time ago, no, your surgery, don't do any surgery, don't do any radiation, you don't need to do any of those things. You'll be just fine. 72, we can talk about this stuff. When you turn 72, we can talk about this stuff. You don't have to do it. I didn't go back to him. But the point that I think I'm trying to make here is that regrets would come.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you would have lost something important that's not restorable. The standard of care for breast cancer 30, 40 years ago was just total removal of the breast. Mm-hmm. That's not the standard of care anymore.
Yeah.
Standard of care is more targeted solutions that still allows the woman a dignity of having a breast. That's not the case. That's not what the men surgeons are. That's not what they are proclaiming. Although there are now a different standard, an emerging standard that men have to be aware of. And the more men are aware that you don't have to lose any of these things. You can still be functional, fully functional with the new therapies coming on board. I think the easier it is that we will find them coming out and getting checked and getting treated, because they don't have to lose their dignity. They don't have to lose their manhood. They don't have to lose their perceived confidence. Like I can say for me, that's not where I gain my confidence from. But that's me, that's personal. The people that confidence come from a different place. So I think the journey through prostate cancer is evolving, and the pace of evolution is going to be rapid. Before you subject yourself to radical treatments, which most of the current urologists still claim to be standard of care, you have to look a little harder.
Yeah.
And you have to talk a lot more. And last resort has to be this prostatectomy. There are people working very hard all the time trying to find new solutions.
Yeah. Whew, there's so much to wrap up with that. But I just want to say thank you. Thank you for just walking us through behind the scenes, right? And it's not one that we always have access to, or even being able to draw a string through our actions and the consequences as well. And for those that might be wondering, why didn't your doctor tell you about other kinds of treatment? Unfortunately, the way it is for most places, especially in the US, you are restricted to, if you're living in a geographic setting, for example, whatever sources of expertise you have, you tend to be restricted to it. So some men will have to travel maybe out of the states, maybe even 500, 1,000 miles away to get comprehensive care. And not everyone has that luxury, right? In Mr. Dollar's case, I don't think he was restricted by that. But again, depending on the level of expertise his physicians have, and for example, surgeons like to cut. So a surgeon will highly recommend surgery to you. That might not end up being the best option for you. So this is why second, third, and fourth opinions matter. Don't rush into it and then have those decisional regrets later, okay? That's what we're trying to say here. I have a podcast group where we have themes every month, and where we listen and then we come together and talk about it. For this month's theme, it's on regrets. And there's something I learned. There's this idea in psychology. There are two types of regret. One is regret for something we did, so regret of commission. And then the other is regret of what we didn't do, regret of omission. And studies have shown that we tend to live with the regrets of what we didn't do. But I think that in healthcare, it's the things we did, you know, with the best intentions, that we revisit the most. And I think that in your case, Mr. Leia, the fact that you can reflect on this openly, I think is powerful. And it shows the integrity and growth that comes only from lived experience. And you're not just only helping people navigate prostate cancer, but you're also showing what it looks like to be human in it. So thank you for all you do. Now, for this next question. Sorry, go ahead, Sam.
No, thank you.
We can keep saying thank you. And I think you can help. You can win me in this game, you know? My mother is literally in the next room, so I'll win you in this game. Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. So, let's talk about recovery, right? I think healing is less about returning to who we were and more about learning, you know, what we were becoming. And recovery, I think, is often framed as a finish line. But in talking to you, it feels like a thoughtful recalibration. And you have been very vocal about saying survivor is a misnomer when it comes to prostate cancer. Can you unpack what all of that means to you?
Ah, great question. How did you know to ask this one?
I wonder why. Was it a yellow highlight?
You know, it's I have deep respect for everybody that's gone through this journey ahead of me, and trusting their opinion and their experiences. And one of the reasons why doing this podcast today is critical for me is because I don't want to forget. Don't want to forget this experience, because then I don't want to get it camouflaged, the story I tell in the future, or the future people that are coming behind me. I think it's important to be very careful not to drown out the experiences or the feelings of the people that feel differently about their prostate cancer. There may be people out there that have actually survived cancer, survived prostate cancer, you know, more specifically. And that's great. If you are somebody who has kidney cancer, I don't know if that exists, and they took out your kidney and put a new one in there, yeah, maybe you survived it because your body is still back doing the same thing it was doing before. When you have prostate cancer and your prostate is removed, you don't have the privilege of saying, in my view, you've survived the cancer. You're going through a transformation. So the word survivor itself is supposed to be empowering. That's why people use it all the time. But for many of us who's faced prostate cancer and made the difficult decision to have the prostate removed, that word doesn't quite fit. It just doesn't fit. Yes, I am alive. Yes, by the grace of God, the cancer is gone. The wound is healing. But I am not as I was. What few people tell you before surgery is that the physical recovery is only the beginning. I'm not through it. I'm still going through the physical recovery. I feel it every day. My body is still adjusting. What comes afterward, as I'm beginning to realize, is a quiet, often invisible grieving. Grieving of the loss. I asked my surgeons when they were going into surgery to take a picture of my prostate when they removed it. They forgot.
Oh no.
Yeah, I would put it on the
wall. The one thing you asked them to do. They have just one job apart from saving.
Yes, sir. Yeah, just keep it so I can see it and say hi to me every morning. But you grieve not only what you lost, but who you were before. Your sense of self changes. Your sense of masculinity, of sexual identity, of confidence, all can be shaken. No one prepares you for that. Probably no one can, because this is individual. But to deny that there are people that feel this way, I think it's a disservice to a lot of people. So healing comes when it does, when it becomes less about returning to what you were before, but more about accepting what is now, who you have become, or who you are transforming to become. Right? That's when healing actually happens. And this is where the language survivor for me feels final, victorious. There's nothing final about this journey. It continues. silently, daily. Instead of calling myself a survivor, I would say I'm a man who has lived through cancer and carries his legacy. I live with this scar and this story. So if you're facing, this is to the men that may be listening to the podcast, if you're facing this decision, know that it's okay to grieve. It's okay. You are allowed to feel the weight of what's at stake. And when you come through it, you may not feel like a survivor, but you will be you, changed perhaps, but not diminished. That's the truth. Mm. That is my truth. Mm. It's a quiet burden that everybody carries. Some suppress it because that's the way they deal. And some embrace it because this is about transformation. I am going to be transformed. I am going to be used differently than what I was before the treatment. And I'm going to be grateful because that's where I am. I offer this not for sympathy or for solidarity. So for the man that's staring down the decision, the diagnosis, and trying to weigh their risks, regrets, the future,
yeah,
you're not alone. Your experience, your fears, your grief, they are valid. Yeah. Whatever path you take, you will still be whole. Different, yes,
yeah,
but whole.
You painted a picture I think will stay with some. Thank you, by the way, sir. When you contrasted, you know, like kidney transplant to removing one's prostate, you're right. There's no, last I checked, there's no prostate, you know, replacement surgery that's been handed out. There's a loss there, right? And when you said, I'm a man who has lived through cancer and carries his legacy, whew, that was so honest and so real. And thank you so much for that reminder. I think, especially to the men listening, that it's okay to grieve, to not rush into resolution, to just sit with the weight of it all. I think that's powerful, especially in communities where that kind of vulnerability is really giving space. So thank you, sir, for giving us that space today and for naming something that many people carry, but a few have the words for. As we come to a close, I'd like to talk a little bit about the emotional aspect of things. I mean, in listening to your story and hearing all you've shared today, I think a lot of our listeners will leave with a deeper understanding of your process, that you were very thoughtful about your journey. And that came from not just the insight you have about yourself and that self-awareness, but also the robust support from your family, right? And making sure that they were carried along and every step you took was something that, you know, was you know, informed from all of those processes. What would you say was the biggest shift emotionally for you before you had your surgery and after you had your surgery? And I know you had the active surveillance phase, which maybe there was some shift in between, but I think the biggest catalytic shift for you was, you know, post-surgery. What would you say has been the biggest change emotionally, especially from a man's perspective, that you'd like to leave with us today, sir?
I think, and I don't know if I've gotten to the conclusion of my shifting quite yet. I believe that it's a journey. But going into, and so just really, really quickly, it wasn't a decision that was not made with good thought, the decision to go to surgery. In fact, maybe I even pushed reversed. I asked a lot of tough questions of my doctors because came in there and just gone through the rigorous PET scan.
Yeah.
And everything still looked like they were in the same place. There was some millimeter change movement in the radius of the cancer they were seeing, but they still were not definitive. So, but the PSA was going up. And I had been praying without ceasing that my PSA would go down, because if my PSA had gone down, I would have been okay. It had been going up and down, but the trajectory was always going up.
Mm.
And at that point in time, I decided that, well, I've done everything I know to do. I've done all the herbs, I've done all the medication, I've done all the exercises, I've done everything humanly possible to do. And so I am at a point now, at a crossroad, where there's a tick up in the size of the the cancer. Still in this stage 1 and 2. But the PSA is going up and it was inexplicable. Nobody can tell me why. So it was time to make a decision. Fork in the road. And we decided to go into that. My sister came down from California. I was a physician who spent a lot of time doing the research around these treatments and has connected me with different surgeons all over the world. And she sat down with me and we looked at all the pictures and decided that, well, this is the decision to make and this is the time to make that decision.
Yeah.
I didn't bring together my whole team, my closest family members. My wife was away in Michigan at the time. And I didn't bring them because I felt like if I was going to make this decision, it has to be a decision that doesn't put a burden on them. I have been very selfish in a way because I always talked about quality of life. But if I made a wrong decision, then now I become a big cancer candidate, where I got cancer spread all over me, then that the burden of treating me or caring for me now becomes my immediate family members' problems. I didn't want them in that part of the decision. I had to make that decision myself for me. And that's how we went ahead into the surgery. The loss after surgery didn't come immediately because I still had to go through that whole catheter thing, which I think I cried a couple of times in that process because this is, I've never had this dependent and stuff, and this is just a different experience. I don't know where we're going with this. So it was a very emotional time for me in the process. But the comfort from my family, my very close friends, there was always somebody checking on me. They still do. Even 5 months into it, people are always coming and checking on me quietly. I had one of my new friends from my job at Zion's Man call me last night. And we talked about what has gone on in the last several months. So random people call just to check to make sure I'm okay. But it's okay to be vulnerable, as we talked about. It's okay to feel vulnerable and to feel or to grieve, because that's part of the healing process. It's like if somebody died and you go in there as macho, you never grieve for the death of your loved one. You never ever choose to because she wanted to be strong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe some people can deal with it and live with it. But most people are just burying that stuff deep, which means that they are going to live life in probably a reactive mode. So you have to, it's what we've been taught, is that you have to deal with these losses. The loss of your prostate is an important loss. So I deal with it that way. I don't dwell on it. And I don't, as time has passed, and this is why I said earlier on, I don't want too much time to pass so I forget what the experience was, because then I won't be able to teach people how to get through this season of life if they have to go in there. My first priority, of course, is don't do it. Don't get in there.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to prevent prostate cancer. I don't think anybody knows it yet.
Not yet, yeah. It's such a, because we don't know genetics, you know, environmental exposures, or it's a combination of those things, and it's so hard to say what exactly is the cost of it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So to the extent that some of us have to go through it, I want to be part of that information bank where people can, if it's just one person, glimpse a path forward that works better for them and that gets them a little bit more prepared than I was, even though I thought I was the most prepared. I went through, insisted that I saw all the experts in the field around, and you're very correct, my geographic spread, which limited my experience or my discussion, was part of my limitation, I think. It was only in Utah, and those are the only consultants I consulted, even though I knew there were probably just as many experts elsewhere in the world or in the country that I could have reached out to and may have informed me differently. So I love solving problems, and this is a problem that I thought I had, and I don't know the root cause, which is always something that I strive for, and I will never know the root cause. But the systematic approach of trying to look at all the options and evaluating those options on their merit and the potential outcomes of those options, I think it led me to a place where I concluded that, okay, all things told and all persons involved, I made the right decision for me at the time.
You did it.
And I am happy to live with that decision because I made the decision with all the best information I could get my hands on.
Yeah. Thank you so, so much, sir. Lastly for me would be, as we, now that you've come to through such a significant turning point, and in just reflecting back on your story, what do you hope to focus on moving forward, personally or in service to others?
My personal focus is really, one, getting physically back. I can't exercise because of the hernia. I can't exercise like I used to, so I feel that. As I always say, anything that heals me, anything that ails me, can be fixed if I exercise. And if I can't exercise, then I can't heal as much. So until I can get to a physical state where my body from surgery is fully healed, I'm still restricted in how much I can do. Every time I move up or stand up, unless I'm lying down, this bubble hernia is over there. I have played with myself in that spot as many times as I remember. I have never touched my navel as many times because it's right above my navel. Ever. I think collectively my life, I think I can never touch my navel that many times. So the first aspect is the physical healing. And then, of course, the emotional healing. I think I'm well along the way. Then there's this physical and psychological space that I think that's the mental aspect of it. So that's one. I'm going to give myself as much time as I need to get my arms around it. But part of that healing is going to come when I'm able to start impacting people in positive ways. So when I said earlier on that this has to be a purpose, there has to be a reason why I went through this stuff, even though in retrospect it probably was premature. Mm-hmm. There was a reason. If I had waited, I wouldn't experience what I'm talking about.
About now, yeah.
Still be pontificating from a position of theory and hearsay. But now I can speak.
Experiential wisdom, yeah.
Exactly. I can speak from that position and I can inform people. So what's still left for me to do is advocating, telling people about go to the hospital or go to your doctor, or you see the urologist all the time, and making sure you're aware of this is one step. The other step is educating people about what is out there and what path you can take or you should consider taking as you make a decision. I think that's just as important. People want solutions, and I live my life providing solutions. Information is good. So in any capacity, I just got a long email request today. I haven't poured through it yet, about how do we, so we got the men, not just the one that I inflicted by this disease, but the men in general, how do we take them through a life that one allows them or that empowers them to know it's okay to get checked?
Yeah.
But even when you're checked, there are solutions out there, unless you're on the verge of dying, there are solutions out there that allows you to still maintain all the things that are important to you.
Yeah.
And they're there. They are, the solutions are there. They're evolving every time. So my job is to figure out what the pace of change is and start broadcasting them. We used to get, when we did our outreach, we got addresses of the people that we came through.
Yeah.
And the addresses, yeah, if they have them, but also the compound where they were from. So we know the name, we have their phone numbers, which we change. We know what their abuela is.
Yeah.
The compound. You can always track them down. If I go back to my database, may I go to Nigeria, my goal is going to be to track some of those men down and see what their status is, because we have now done a good job of that.
Yeah.
And going forward, that's something we're going to change.
And that is the introspective part of you. Again, it's bridging what you now know with still the heart for the community. And I imagine when you talked about earlier on about how if your physician hasn't gone through what you've gone through, they can only just keep pontificating. But now that you've walked through this path, I imagine that the next time you go back on the field through your foundation, you're coming from, you know, that heart you already had for service, but also bridging that with your experiences. So that way you can help, you know, inform and guide other men in that journey. And that is beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. Lastly, would be about your foundation. Are you guys still, I imagine you guys are still doing it. Maybe just tell us a little bit about it. And for those who might be interested in knowing more, where can they find it?
So they have a website out there, www.aoof.org. Since COVID, we've had to reconfigure how we actually go about our outreach, and that reconfiguration is an evolution. It's changing every year, I would say. We like to be attentive to the community and the needs. AOOF does three things mainly. Primary things we do, healthcare and education in that domain. Healthcare is screening the community for various ailments that we think is endemic in that area. and it's free. We provide general analgesic and vitamins and just general supplies that encourages people for a period of time to get healthy and get into the habit, knowing that they can do more. But we also recognize that these people that we serve and not in the affluent part of the country, that they are indigents and they have very little. And so we always interact with their churches and help them, and mosques, and help them in that way. In the education aspect, we provide scholarships. And we have sponsored over 500, 600 students over several years through universities that graduated them. And one of the aspects of that that's painful for me and remains so is that we graduate these students from colleges and we can't find them jobs because of the employment system in Nigeria. Yeah. And that's what led me away from banking and led me to this prime grid energy solution that we're trying to promote in Nigeria. Still very active. Once we can get the power situation in Nigeria under control and manageable and cost effective, I think the employers, as I have talked to many of them, will have more funds to expand their business and maybe even hire new people. But that's a constraint that I'm working on. But AOF has done a lot of good. We collaborate with the community on those two fronts. And then we, from the health care standpoint, we help from an infrastructure that we help to build infrastructure to support healthcare and also help the schools in some ways to build maybe new buildings, add new blocks to their new classroom blocks to their facilities. Because of COVID and because of the security situation in Nigeria, we have been reluctant to bring people from because we have been told to stay back, and but it's time to get back in there. So we've empowered other people there locally to do the work on our behalf. We don't pay anyone. All of the people that help us are volunteers, pure volunteers. And the people, we had a lot of people in the U.S. that have been sponsors over the years. Some of them for as long as we have been doing the business.
Wow.
And then, of course, we tax, as I say, we tax the members of the family as well to make sure that we are honoring the legacy of the old man.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow. I'm sure he'll be very proud of all you've done. These are all of my questions. I just wanted to give you, if you had anything you'd like to add to tie it up, I'll just do the outro. But I wanted to give you just, you know, some time to maybe say anything you wanted to maybe add to it, or if you don't have anything, just let me know. But this is your time to finish
No, this has been great. I've had a great time. I think it's been a pleasure talking to you and talking through this. For in a way, it's been cathartic for me as well. It's allowed me to reflect and express myself in a more structured way. My feelings and my thoughts sometimes are all over the place and they're random. And this process has allowed me to be more deliberate and concise. One of the things, so growing up back in the 60s, we had a library at home. The library had Encyclopedia Britannica and all the great books that were written about that time. And I always, when I talk to the kids as we award and scholarships. Some of my dad's quotes always come to me. And the one that I think comes to me to close with, and for folks to share or to ponder, is the one that goes, "Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change those I can,
and the wisdom,
to know the difference." I think that's a powerful quote. And I pray that all our listeners get empowered by that phrase, by that prayer, and that whatever decisions they make in this space, that they are eventually accepting of it.
Yeah.
Knowing what the difference between the ones that can make a difference or the change and the ones that can't change. So thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation very much.
Remember how I said you cannot outthink me? Not on my podcast. Thank you, sir. I'm going to turn it back to you and say thank you. And I mean, in our cab meetings and just the strength and the wisdom you always come with, I wasn't surprised to see that, you know, come out here, because that's just who you are. Thank you for always sharing of yourself, and for even walking us through the process, you know, that brought you to your decisions. And you invited us into this quiet, complicated space where healing actually lives. And I hope it's going, and I know it's something that will stay in the hallowed space of podcasting, because it's always evergreen. And I hope people would always go back and draw strength from it. And you shared so many things that would stay with me, but I just love how you reframed the word survival, because we use that all the time. And we don't pause enough to ask if it fits everyone's story. Now, because for you and so many others, it's not really about conquering, but it's also about continuing, right? About carrying those experiences and learning to live well. So to the men listening or anyone working beside someone on this journey, we hope this episode made you feel heard. And the permission in those words that Mr. Adole shared, the reminder that it's okay to grieve, to change your mind, to ask questions, and to not have it all figured out. And so thank you, Mr. Adelaide, for your honesty, for your heart, for your wisdom, for your courage as well, reminding us that healing is real, it's layered. And to our listeners, please take care of your body. Yes, find you doctors who will listen to you. Find you communities that will support you, your men friend, your girlfriends, your partners, your kids. Find people you can, you know, hold on to, but also take care of your spirits. Check in on your people. And remember, there's more than one way to be whole. We'll see you next time. This has been the Most Civil Podcast, and I remain your host, Mo. Thank you so much, sir. This was really great, and I'm glad we finally got to do it.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. I'd like to take a selfie with you so we can share it with, you know, our lovely group. So I'll let you know whenever you're ready.
I am.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, go.
Yes.
All right. Coffee captured, and I will end the recording. Thank you.